Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The race is on to wrap up emergency repairs to several stretches of Interstate 80 before the winter season really gets going. Last season's epic rain, wind, and snow are still causing problems on portions of I-80. Caltrans and its contractors are still working to make sure the roads are safe for winter travel. It is a lot of work, and the price tag is steep. We're talking close to $85 million worth of repairs on just I-80 alone. There are five hot spots for repairs in the Sierra, and whether you travel up to the foothills or Tahoe regularly, or if you just have plans for the upcoming holidays, it helps to keep tabs on those projects. Joining us to help navigate the repair work, the timelines, and the resources is Jeremy Linder with Caltrans District 3. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with a visual of District 3 because it is big. It covers 11 counties. Some of those counties are Glenn, Colusa, Butte, Sierra, all the way down to, you know, Yolo, Placer, El Dorado, and I know I missed a few. But aside from I-80, what have repairs been like this year across such a large area?
I mean, it's typical. Because we have such a large area, we've got some of the major highways within the Sacramento metro area. I-5, 50, 80, head a little farther north or south, 99, 70, 65 in the Roseville area. So it's been a typical year. I mean, we've got our big construction projects that we work through during the summer season. And then now going into winter season, we got to be prepared for whatever Mother Nature brings us, whether it's flooding, dry conditions, a lot of snow, little snow, you never really know.
Yeah. And when it comes to the stretch of I-80 that we're going to dive into, I mean, it is typical during winters or healthy winter seasons for that stretch to really get hammered. But last winter season was pretty extraordinary. Even Caltrans, I believe at the beginning of the year, called the damage unprecedented. You know, taking a look back with hindsight, was the damage from rain, wind, and snow, cars and trucks, or was it kind of just like a combination of everything?
It was a combination. Mostly snow. I mean, we saw a lot of snow in an extended period of time, which meant more chain restrictions, more closures in place. So the majority of the damage we saw was just all due to chain wear. And just constantly all those travelers heading up and down the mountain. I mean, it eats at the pavement. We do what we can to keep conditions safe. That's why those chain restrictions are in place. And then after the season wraps up, then we take a look at what happened. And because it was such a big year, we notice just a lot more damage than what we had seen previously. That's why for the district, it was unprecedented. The ruts were deep. Some of the concrete slabs were pretty cracked. That's why the repairs were varying from simple asphalt pavement to just quick little patchwork to full concrete sections that had to be dug out and then re-poured.
Oh, okay, so what I'm learning is, like, because these emergency repairs were announced at the end of August, so you basically had to wait for, you know, things to get warmer to kind of take a forensic analysis of what the roads look like.
Exactly. So our crews went up around the June timeframe to take a look at exactly what the conditions were, what we were seeing. Then, of course, we got to wait for the funding involved before we could green light the crews to even start work. Plus, we also had the factor of just the summer travel season. 80 is a very busy corridor. Everyone wants to go up to Tahoe when there's snow. Everyone wants to go to Tahoe when the lake is full. So we try to figure out what the best time frame to have as little of an impact to the traveling public as possible. That's why we end up ultimately didn't really start all five sections until after Labor Day.
Yeah, and we're talking about a roughly 70-mile stretch when we're looking at these repairs from Colfax to State Line. It may not seem like that long of a stretch when we're talking about interstates in California, but it gets a lot of traffic, as you just laid out. Before we get into the specific areas, those hot spots, was there an overall strategy of how to tackle this in a relatively short amount of time with another winter approaching?
So one of the big strategies that we did, because you're right, it is such a long stretch of highway, instead of trying to make that one single project, we broke it up into five. So that allowed us for each section to focus on whatever type of repairs was needed, but it also allowed us to utilize five different contractors and work with them simultaneously.
Mm. Okay, so let's get to the first part. I'm going to start from Sacramento, and then we're going to head east on I-80. So the first spot is between Colfax and Alta. So that's before Blue Canyon. So what work is being done there?
So right now, work is actually the majority of it. It's done. That was just asphalt pavement. So they had the easiest job out of all five sections. We had a closure of westbound I-80 a couple of weeks ago. That was as we were going through the Colfax Narrows, which was the final piece to that puzzle. There's a few checkoff items that we'd like to complete before we ultimately say it's finished, but at least the paving is all done.
And then, so the next stretch, though, is from Alta to Yuba Pass. So is that different, or is there still work ongoing there?
So there's still work ongoing. What you see, especially with the change in the elevation, the type of the surface of the highway changes. Instead of asphalt, now we're dealing with concrete because it's a little more durable to the chain wear. Plus, with all the temperature, the weather conditions, it can change drastically between those two spots. So because of that change in product, the repairs are a little bit different. That's where we're having to do a lot more of those rut repairs, where we're grinding the grooves, smoothing things out, and then re-pouring a polyester concrete mix to patch everything up and get it smooth again. I think most of the motorists, especially during the summer, when they hit those areas or if they were in the slow lane, they really noticed it because their car was either shaking or they noticed their wheels were stuck in that groove and sort of forcing you to go in a certain direction based off of how it was laid out in a section.
Given that there's still ongoing work on this spot, should drivers be aware of any advisories if they're going to be heading up that way?
So every week is different. I mean, we're trying to tackle a lot. So just keep on top of, I've been updating every Friday, send out a new traffic alert, letting everyone know what those sections are. We're posting it to social media, to our website as well. So it's more just checking and making sure you know exactly what sections you might be hitting. The good rule of thumb, I know everyone's been trying to call and be like, when's the best time? Can I avoid it if I go early in the morning? And really, the answer is no. In some spots, we're doing work around the clock. Now, the good thing to know is, it's not like the entire highway shut down. It's just being the lanes are reduced. So you'll have a little bit of a backup, but then traffic will run smoothly through each of those sections. And they're not very long either. They have a break in between each spot of repairs.
Yeah, a little bit of congestion, but it's moving. you can get to your destination. So we did Colfax to Alta, Alta to Yuba Pass. Now we're heading even further higher in elevation, going from Yuba Pass to Kingvale. Yes. What is the scope of work along this stretch?
So that stretch, it's the same. We're seeing a lot of rut repair, but now we're getting into the concrete slab replacements as well. So these were the particular sections that the damage was a little more
intense. So it's getting
intense.
More severe as you go higher up in elevation.
In some spots, yeah. Everyone had a little bit different, but it makes sense, especially once you go into the Kingvale area. Now you're going near Donner Pass. You're getting to the highest point of I-80 within California. Now we're looking at an area that typically has a lot more chain controls in place for a longer duration.
Yeah. And so that brings us to part four, which is to Kingvale to Truckee. So you do have to cross Donner Pass, Donner Summit. What is the scale of work that's happening there? Because that's really the highest. It's like 7,000 feet in elevation.
Yeah. So it's very similar. A lot of rut repair, concrete slab replacements. These slabs, we saw some cracking involved. So that's why our crews ultimately looked at, could we just simply do a little bit of a patchwork, get through this winter before we evaluate again, or did it ultimately need a much bigger improvement so that we don't have a larger issue come next winter? And that's ultimately why we did these emergency repairs, is we saw such a great year with snow led to some conditions on the highway that we knew we needed to improve, but without knowing what this season could bring, we didn't want it to be any worse going into 2024.
Yeah. And the last stretch is Truckee to State Line. Is this in line with the other work that's going on, or are there some differences?
Very similar. The one thing that's unique about that section is we're actually doing a trial program. Shot blasting the highway. So on top of the normal repairs, what the shot blasting does is basically shoot really tiny steel balls at the surface. And then it allows the friction on the roadway to increase, gives a little more traction. This is a typical thing that we do in the valley along the bridge decks. First time we've done it in the Sierra. So that's why it's a trial to get a feel of how it improves conditions, how long is that lifespan of improvement, and ultimately, will it reduce the amount of spinouts or motorists losing traction as they continue into Nevada?
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jeremy Linder with Caltrans about the emergency repairs on Interstate 80 in the Sierra. So there are also, Jeremy, a lot of lesser traveled roads in the Sierra, or not as busy as I-80, but Caltrans is responsible for. They also are important thoroughfares in the Sierra. What kind of damage did you discover along like State Route 20 in Nevada County? That takes you from Immigrant Gap to Yuba City. You pass through Nevada City along the way.
So 20 was its own beast. We have the Omega Curbs.
It's more rural.
And we had an active construction project in that area. So not as much damage that we saw on 80, also because it doesn't see the sheer amount of number of traffic during the winter. We also had conditions where it was shut down for a period of time because of that. So mostly what we focused for there was just finishing the Omega Curves project. We were realigning a lot of those sharp curves within two sections, and that's helped to help increase the safety in the area. But by focusing on that, we were making sure that A, that project gets done on time, because we're hoping to have things wrapped up middle of this month, but also having it completely ready for the winter season.
Mm. There are also other state routes. I mean, there's State Route 89 and 267. 89 takes you from Truckee to Tahoe City, and then 267 goes from Truckee to Kings Beach. So, you know, on the north and western parts of Tahoe, are there unique challenges to repairing this? Because those are also very popular roads to take.
They are. I won't say there's unique challenges. I mean, very similar, no matter what type of a roadway you're on, whether it's a main interstate or just a normal state route highway. Anyway, for 89 and 267, the main work that we did was a lot of pothole repairs. A lot of customers were complaining about just those conditions and just how dangerous trying to avoid them could be. So we really focused on that, trying to, again, make sure that we were ready for the winter season. And then we'll continue looking at those conditions going into next year, knowing that, okay, there could be more work that needs to be done.
All right. So you got to look at the damage like over the summer. You announced the emergency repairs at the end of August. Today's November 2nd. I know timelines can fluctuate, but overall, especially with the I-80 portion, how much of these emergency repairs are completed today, and when do you expect them to be entirely completed?
So I haven't heard a percentage yet from our crews. They're constantly working on what they can do. Our big factor, obviously, is Mother Nature. We're at the point now that we are hoping to squeeze two more weeks of those emergency repairs in before conditions reach that point that we can't do anything more. Ultimately, looking at it, most likely, especially if we get a really good winter season again, we're going to have to come back next year, no matter what, whether it's little repairs or additional repairs on top of whatever chain wear that we see this season. So ultimately, I'd love to say, yeah, we're done. But realistically, it's an ongoing effort, especially with 80.
When it comes to the more sizable repairs that you're currently working on along this stretch of I-80, do you hope or expect that it'll be wrapped up by like Thanksgiving?
Ideally, yeah, especially, I mean, because of those winter conditions that we have to watch. I mean, it's not only temperature, but we're looking at the rain and the snow forecast. Ultimately, I mean, when you look at the forecasts happening for this weekend going into next week, that sort of delays everything. And we reach a point that with the temperature, we're just not getting the right conditions to allow the concrete to cure properly. So that's why ultimately we have to make that decision. And it's around Thanksgiving that we've done as much as we can, and we won't be able to continue into the winter season.
When it comes to the funding, I mean, this is costing roughly $85 million. Where does the money come from, the funding?
I'd have to double check the source, but this was an emergency director's order. So it's one of those that we have money set aside for a lot of these projects. So they have the ability to pull from several different sources. It's not like a much larger construction where there's a combination of state, federal, local funding. These ones are a little more, because they're an emergency, we know we need to be quick acting. And by having those set aside ready to go, and then once we are basically given the approval, then we know, okay, we're moving forward, because ultimately it needs to be done and we can't wait too long.
What do you want drivers to keep in mind if they're going to be heading up I-80 this weekend?
So the big one is just, we ask everyone, slow down, be cautious, know these sections, be mindful of the signs out there when it's saying that lanes are merging down. Take your time, So far, delays have been fairly minimal. If you go through all the sections to Nevada on a regular day, we're not seeing any more than maybe 40, 45 minutes tops. And that's to go through all five locations at once. So ultimately, it's not too bad. You're not going to be stuck in stop-and-go traffic like they see in the Bay Area. You'll just be slowing down. You won't be going 65 all the time. So just be prepared for that. And then, of course, now that we are entering winter season, construction will be wrapping up. But you want to remember now our focus is going to go to the exact opposite spectrum of being prepared for whatever Mother Nature brings us. And that does mean having chains in that backseat or trunk 24/7.
I know. When I was a field reporter, I have been up I-80 many, many times when there have been spinouts or the interstate was shut down due to some drivers. And, you know, and obviously, you know, it's unsafe driving conditions. You know, what do you want drivers to keep in mind? Not everyone brings chains. Some people chance it. And time again, this happens. What do you want them to keep in mind as we are getting closer to those winter months?
The big thing is to ultimately, don't chance it. Watch the forecast very closely. If you know you're heading up in a certain time frame, be prepared for whatever Mother Nature brings us. And if it ultimately is snow, you need to be ready. You have to have those chains with you no matter what the restrictions are to be prepared. Because if you are stuck or you try to bypass the chain restrictions because you didn't pack them, you're ultimately putting yourself in a position that, say, you have a spin out on one of those secondary routes that are not covered by Caltrans. You don't know how long you're going to be stuck there, let alone now you're stretching resources a lot thinner than they need to be. If you stay on the main line, then we can concentrate on that and everyone will be able to get through as safely and smoothly as possible. So just ultimately, it's just always be prepared, whether it is a dry, sunny day or if it's almost whiteout conditions, 32 degrees and snowing. You just make sure you're ready.
Quickly, where can people stay up to date with road conditions? Where's the best place for them to go?
The best is going to be Quick Map. You can pull it up on your desktop. We have an app for both all smartphone devices. So that way it's real-time data. You can see what's going on the highway. You can see the slowdowns. It's got the green, yellow, orange, red markers. And when we go into the winter season, you can actually see where the chain restrictions are in place, where the snow plows are in real time. So it's your best resources to just all in one go right there.
Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeremy Linder is a spokesperson for Caltrans District 3, getting us up to speed on all the work that's happening between Sacramento and Tahoe and State Line ahead of a busy holiday season. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Governor Newsom is coming off a week-long trip to China, and behind the international stage of photo ops and pomp and circumstance is a lot at stake because China shapes the Golden State's success. From climate initiatives to tourism, tech, education, the country, which is also a competitor, touches many arms of California's economy. But a trip of this scale is far from simple, given U.S.-China relations are strained for reasons that include human rights and intellectual property. It is a trip that is difficult to digest from overseas. Luckily, a handful of California journalists joined the governor along the way. And that includes Sophia Boleg, who is a political reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. And Sophia joins us with more about what the governor's trip to China accomplished and where California fits into all of this. Welcome, Sophia. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
Hardest question first. Were you jet lagged when you got back?
You know, yes, I was. And I've really tried to push through it because it is a wild time difference. It's I think we're 15 hours behind here. So,
and it's not like the work stops when you land back in California.
No. The work continues. So
it keeps going. Well, thank you for joining us. So Governor Newsom, he's not the first governor to make a trip to China. Governor Jerry Brown, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, they have gone as well. Can you remind us how China influences California's economy?
Yeah, so there are a lot of connections between California's economy and China. I report primarily for a Bay Area audience, and so I always think about the high tech sector. There's a lot of Chinese immigrants who come to Silicon Valley to work, and there's just a lot of sort of, movement between the state and the country a lot of sort of influence there. Tourism is also a really huge area. Pre-pandemic, China made up, I believe, almost half of, or Chinese visitors made up almost half of the visitors from abroad who were coming to California. Yeah, and the amount of Chinese tourism into California has really declined dramatically since the pandemic started. And so that's been a big hit to California's tourism industry. And so that's another major aspect of sort of the economics. China is also a major trade partner in terms of agriculture and a lot of other industries. And so there's a really significant economic relationship between China and California.
And it can be easy to overlook it, you know, because it also dates back, you know, decades and generations as well. When you first got word that the governor is going to be traveling to China, what stood out to you? Was it a surprise or was it a move that you seemed was that you thought was in line with the governor's priorities?
So it was a bit of a surprise because Newsom has not traveled internationally since 2019. I actually also covered his first international trip in 2019, which was to El Salvador. Newsom told me when I interviewed him on this more recent trip to China that, you know, if the pandemic hadn't hit, that he likely would have traveled to other countries in, you know, Central America and perhaps South America as well, you know, countries south of the United States that have important ties to California. But the pandemic hit, and of course, that scrambled everything. And so he hasn't taken another international trip. I think he likely would have done more international travel if there hadn't been a pandemic in the middle of his tenure. And so it was kind of a surprise for that reason. But as you mentioned, this is not the first time a governor of California has gone to China. Newsom actually traveled to China a number of times when he was mayor of San Francisco. So it is not unheard of, but it is a really striking time for him to go, given that there are, you know, serious tensions in the U.S.-China relationship. And also, you know, this is a moment when there is a lot of conflict in the world. Before Newsom went to China, actually, the trip to China had been planned for weeks, but he made sort of a quick detour on the way to stop in Israel and meet with the prime minister there and also meet with families of Californians who had been kidnapped or who were affected by the war in Gaza. And so, you know, this trip came at a time of really tense international relations on a lot of different fronts.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to China, what's in it for China to welcome the governor?
Yeah, so and the welcome was really striking. A lot of pomp and circumstance, a lot of excitement in China that the governor was traveling there. I think China gets a number of things out of a visit like this. I mean, one is sort of almost like tourism promotion. You know, there are pictures of the governor taken on the Great Wall of China, at the Forbidden City, which are some of the, you know, most iconic landmarks in the country. And, you know, China benefits from tourism from California as well. So there's that. I also think that, you know, the primary focus of the governor's trip was climate collaboration between the two countries. And in a lot of meetings, the Chinese officials that Newsom met with really talked about how that was important. It was important to collaborate with California on climate issues and that what are called sort of subnational relationships, so relationships between, you know, states and in this case, California and provinces in China, that those are seen as an important area of collaboration. And then also, you know, more broadly, a lot of the officials talked about how important it was to see an improvement in the relationship between the U.S. and China. They talked about how, you know, a thawing of sort of tensions there was really important to the country. And they said they really saw Newsom's visit as really making progress toward that or as a symbol of sort of those thawing relations.
Yeah, and that brings me to the Biden administration, you know, because The governor said, you know, he received the Biden administration's blessing to go on this trip. What's in it for President Biden and overall the United States having the governor of California go to China to hopefully thaw relations?
Yeah, well, I unfortunately have not gotten a chance to talk to the president about what he thought about the trip.
I'm sure you would love to.
Yeah, I would. But I think he's been busy. But I did speak with the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns, and he's described Newsom's visit as a real victory for the United States, as I think he said, you know, this is a great day or a great week for the U.S., particularly the meeting that Newsom got with Chinese President Xi Jinping. The ambassador described that meeting, which he sat in on. I was not there. There were no American journalists allowed to witness any part of that meeting. But from the readout and from what Newsom and the ambassador said, essentially, the ambassador described it as a substantive meeting where the governor talked about climate policy and also issues related to fentanyl. And he said that there was, you know, substantive discussion, that it was productive. And to give a little bit of background on fentanyl, which is something I cover a lot as a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, essentially, the fentanyl overdose epidemic here in California has some ties to China because a lot of the precursor chemicals that are used to make the drug are manufactured in China. And so that's something that Newsom says he brought up with President Xi, and that, you know, he's hoping that China will work with California on sort of stemming that supply of those precursor chemicals.
We know that, you know, the governor, you know, he doesn't mince words, and he can be a strong force, especially when speaking out against issues. Did the governor take any hard stances against China while there? I think about like human rights issues for ethnic and religious minorities to, you know, even like I was reminded of like the Chinese spy balloon, you know, relations with Taiwan. I mean, did he take any hard stances while there?
Yeah, so I don't know exactly how hard of stances he took because I was not in, journalists were not allowed in most of the meetings, except for, you know, maybe the first few minutes of a lot of them. He said he did not talk about human rights related issues in his meeting with the president, though he did bring up fentanyl, which is an issue that is a priority for the U.S. And for California. But he did say he talked about human rights issues in meetings he had earlier that day when he met with the president. He also met with the vice president of China, China's foreign minister, and he met with various other top ranking officials in the national government there. And he says he brought up, I don't recall him mentioning the spy balloon, but he did say he brought up issues related to Tibet and Taiwan. A California resident who the United States says is wrongfully detained in China. So he did bring up a number of issues. It's not completely clear to me, because I was not in the meetings, how strong of a stance he took or exactly how much detail he went into. But he did talk about those issues in the meetings. And the ambassador said that he felt like those conversations were productive and were, you know, advancing the United States interests and position on those issues with China, which, as you note, are areas of tension and where the U.S. very much does not agree with what China is doing.
Yeah. And the timing of this trip when it comes to California, San Francisco specifically, I mean, it aligns with APEC, which is the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation, and that will be in San Francisco this month. So what are the economic implications of this?
Yeah, I think that I mentioned the tourism issue. I think that's a big one. Essentially, this trip was kind of almost like a tourism advertisement for, you know, that could potentially encourage visitors from both California and China to travel, you know, between places. I think that the issues related to trade, I spoke with Newsom's top business advisor, Dee Dee Myers, on this trip. And she said that, you know, a lot of the economic cooperation that is really important to California is sort of forging you know, trade partnerships that allow California businesses to do business in China. And I think that APEC is seen as a big part of that. And it's sort of unclear, I think, to everyone involved exactly how much credit Newsom gets for this. But shortly after Newsom's meeting with Xi, the Chinese president agreed to come to APEC and meet with President Biden. In theory, Newsom meeting with him and talking with him, and Newsom said he, you know, personally encouraged the president to travel to the United States and meet with our president here. In theory, that, you know, might have been helpful. So that's another thing that's going to happen at APEC that I think could be very significant.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sophia Bolag, a political reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, about following Governor Newsom on his trip to China. I mean, the way that a journalist like yourself covering politics in the state, covering a governor, has come a long way in just the past couple of years. There were the fair share of obstacles, right, with public health and due to the pandemic largely. How did it feel to go on a reporting trip of this scale again?
I don't know that I've ever been on a reporting trip of this scale. As I mentioned, I did travel and cover the El Salvador trip, which was significantly shorter and just felt much less packed with meetings. We sometimes worked like, I think there was at least one 18-hour day in this trip. It was a lot. There was one day where we started the day on a plane, flying to Shanghai, or actually we might have flown to Yancheng and then taken a train up to Shanghai. And there were like three or four different events in between. There were many what are called MOU signings, Memoranda of Understanding, that are sort of formal agreements between California and government leaders in China to collaborate on environmental issues. There were so many banquets and, you know, fancy receptions for the governor. There was even a stop we took to a wildlife preserve to see these red-crowned cranes, which were huge. They were almost as big as me, and they seemed pretty tame, but they're sort of I can't remember if they're threatened or endangered, but they are a species that, you know, China has worked to conserve and increase the population of. And so it was really cool to see these birds. And it was just sort of a whirlwind of like you're in an official meeting 1 hour and then you get on a bus and then you're out, you know, in the middle of this nature preserve seeing these cranes and watching the governor feed a crane. I mean, it was a whirlwind is really, I think, the best way to describe it.
And going along with that, I mean, the trip also comes with its fair share of photo ops. Some were executed better than others. You know, all didn't go according to plan. I think of a few. You know, there's one about, you know, the governor stumble on the basketball court. Were you there for that?
I was.
One?
It happened right in front of my eyes.
Yeah, can you set it up for us? I mean, the kid's okay.
Yes. As far as I could tell, both the kid and the governor were okay. But what happened is Newsom and his wife, the first partner, Jennifer Siebel Newsom, who joined for just a few days of the trip, they took a visit to a public school in Beijing that has a really impressive like school garden that is used, the food from the garden is used to, feed the students at the school. And that's been the sort of farm to school issues are something that the first partner has really made a priority and that she really cares about. And so they had scheduled this visit to the school and there was this photo op that was very clearly pre-planned where the governor was going to sort of shoot some hoops with two Chinese students. They looked like they were about 10 or 11. And I think it was just supposed to be like a cute photo op. He did a similar photo op back in around 2000, maybe 2003, 2005 with Chinese students in Shanghai when he was mayor of San Francisco. But one thing that did not go according to plan is that as he was playing basketball with these kids, he tripped over one of them and fell. And it was a very embarrassing thing to watch. The clip has gone, I think, viral to some extent, at least. And I think that has been pretty embarrassing for Newsom. Obviously, no one wants to trip and fall in front of people. And it's just, it's a whole other level of magnitude when you are the governor of California making a trip to China and, you know, tripping in front of everyone and then having that broadcast. So, that was quite a remarkable moment on the trip.
And as you highlighted, I mean, there's a great deal of coordination and planning that goes into, you know, the seemingly, you know, kind of natural moments. And sometimes they don't go according to plan. In the last, you know, 30 seconds that we have, you know, what is a trip like this? I mean, including sitting down with Chinese President Xi Jinping, what does it add to the governor's political resume?
I think it's pretty significant. I mean, you know, being a governor, even of a state as large as California, is not seen as a job where you do a lot of foreign policy. And so I think that this is a pretty significant opportunity for Newsom to sort of increase his foreign policy experience. Newsom has repeatedly said, whenever I ask him or anyone else asks him, that he does not want to run for president, but I think everyone sees him as a potential contender. And this is something that certainly could bolster his resume. It's also something that, you know, could be criticized by enemies or rivals who say that he didn't do enough to advance human rights issues or, you know, spent too much time taking photo ops. Certainly, I've seen that criticism, and I think that, you know, time will tell sort of what the takeaway is. But it certainly was, you know, an opportunity for him to do something that governors don't get to do day to day.
Sophia, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Sophia Boleg is a political reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle who traveled to China to follow Governor Newsom's overseas trip, sharing what the trip accomplished and where California fits in. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. He has long been the host of the show Hidden Brain, and Shankar Vedantam has a new series that launches today. It's called Healing 2.0. And over the course of 5 episodes throughout the month of November, Shankar explores how we can change our lives by taking a closer look at a wide range of hardships. I spoke with Shankar about what inspired this series just before the holidays, which was intentional, and what he hopes listeners take away. Well, Shankar, thank you so much for joining us. It really is a treat.
I'm so happy to be here, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
So what inspired the name Healing 2.0? Is there a 1.0?
So we run a number of series throughout the year, Vicky, called the 2.0 series. Some of them are recurring features and some of them are new features. And the idea really of all of the 2.0 series is that we're trying to pull together the latest ideas, the most novel and interesting ideas, put them together in a collection. And the idea is we're presenting it to people as a way of saying, here's a way that we can help you become the 2.0 version of yourself.
So you have 5 episodes coming out each week this month. The first is this week. What conversations did you have to narrow down on these topics?
Well, I think the context here, Vicky, is that when we think about the world, it feels like there's so much pain and suffering out there. You know, my heart feels heavy when I finish listening to the news every day. The time of year is also a difficult time for some people. The holidays are a time of celebration and gathering, of course, but for some people, it's also a time when they're reminded of people who are no longer sitting at the table with them, so it can be a difficult time for people. So as we were thinking about all of these different ideas, we knew that the series was going to run in November, between November and early December, and we decided that we wanted to try and pull together a set of different ideas. So I'm not sure there was necessarily a vetting process where we said, this is the idea that has to go into the series because it speaks to the season or because it speaks to a particular news event. The idea was really, can we put together a constellation of different ideas that can speak to one another in a way that can help people thrive? And that's our hope, is that that's what we've done.
I think a lot of people can relate to what you said about, you know, after listening to the news of the day or reading the news of the day, it can feel really heavy, you know, and it's hard to learn how to cope with that in a healthy and a constructive way. Given that you've long been focused on the nooks and crannies of human behavior and social science, I mean, I think, you know, society doesn't necessarily equip us with the tools to process, reflect, and communicate in a constructive or healthy way, but it does evolve over time. What stands out to you about the time time that we're in and how we talk about mental health and how collectively we talk about coping with anxieties, traumas, and hardships.
Yeah, it's a difficult time for many people. And of course, there's a lot going on in the world. It's difficult to compare one time period with another time period. You know, it's difficult to say we are going through an emotionally more difficult time than people did 5 years ago or 15 years ago. It always seems like the time that we are in, you know, always feels like the most demanding time sometimes, you know, so it's hard to make comparisons between eras. But one of the ideas that we're really interested in exploring is that we actually have more control over how we feel about the things going on around us than we actually think. The first episode in our series, Healing 2.0, is titled Change Your Story, Change Your Life. And the idea here is such an interesting idea, which is that if you think about your life as a book, and the book is divided into different chapters, you know, how you construct the chapters, where you start each chapter and where you end each chapter plays a profoundly important role in how you see your own life. So most of us, of course, you know, think of ourselves as being, you know, like an audience in a theater. We're watching a play and we experience our lives the same way. We feel like our lives are happening to us. We're observing our lives. We're watching what happens. But this episode makes the case that not only are we doing that, but we're also in some ways the author of our lives, or at least the author of the story of our lives. And so the way we tell the story matters enormously. When you think about the chapter breaks in your life, think about a chapter that starts on a very positive note and ends on a very negative note. So you start out with a great job and you move to a new city and you're very excited. But at the end of the story, you know, you lose the job, or the company that you're working with, you know, goes under, or for some other reason, the job doesn't turn out to be what you expected. If you tell the story that way, that story is what psychologists would call a contamination sequence, because it started out positive and it's ended negative. But because all our lives have ups and downs, by moving where we start and stop the chapters of our story, we can also start the chapters on a negative note, on a note of setback, and end the story on a note that is of redemption, of something actually coming out, of the phoenix rising from the ashes, if you will. And psychologists call this a redemption sequence. And as we tell the story of our lives, it turns out we are going to be happier and better adjusted and we'll have better mental health if we can tell more redemption sequences than contamination sequences. So that's the kind of idea that we explore in the series. It's one of many ideas. But we hope these ideas collectively can help people thrive.
Yeah, like wrapping it around with solutions. I mean, the stories that we tell ourselves, the narratives that we tell ourselves can be powerful. And although feelings aren't facts, feelings are powerful as well. And finding a way to deal with them constructively, you know, helps all of us in the long run. When looking at the episodes that you're going to be unveiling this month, I mean, they're all incredibly interesting. The last one, though, I think is so helpful. It's the power of apologies. It can be difficult to want to apologize. Well, it actually might be easy to want to apologize, but it can be difficult to actually apologize. What did you learn from that episode?
Well, it's such an interesting thing because, of course, as we go through life, it's inevitable that we are going to hurt other people and that other people are going to hurt us. It's just, I think it's just a function of being alive that that's going to happen, that we are going to disappoint people, other people are going to disappoint us. And this happens not just at an interpersonal level, it happens at the level of groups. There are groups that are going to harm other groups. There are countries that are going to harm other countries. So it can happen at a small level, it can happen at a big level. So, you know, our capacity to inflict pain on others is just, I think, part of the human condition. And of course, when this happens, the person who has been injured, you know, really feels terrible. It's not just the pain of the injury, it's also the injustice of the injury. The psychological trauma of the injury hangs over the person and hangs over the relationship. And it turns out that apologies are a really powerful way to bridge the chasms that open up as a result of these hurts and traumas. If an apology is expressed well, if it's phrased well, if it is meant sincerely, if it is preceded by a period of listening and contemplation so that you're not just apologizing because it feels like someone told you to apologize, but because you've actually tried to inhabit the life of the person who is experiencing some pain, these apologies have a profound effect in interpersonal settings, and they can also have very profound effects at the level of groups and at the level of nations. I mean, if you think about, you know, the apartheid regime in South Africa and the Truth and Reconciliation, process that unfolded in the aftermath of apartheid, in some ways it's looking at the same idea, which is, can we have an honest accounting of what went wrong and who did what to whom, and an honest account of an apology offered and remorse expressed? It's very difficult to do this, and I think it's very difficult to do this in interpersonal settings, because sometimes our ego gets in the way, our feelings, our emotions get in the way. Sometimes we are so upset ourselves because of the hurt that we are experiencing that we forget to notice somebody else's pain and suffering. And so we say, you know, why should I apologize to you when I'm in pain myself? But of course, in a situation where neither side is able to apologize to the other, you know, recriminations only build up and the relationship goes even further south. So it's a fascinating topic, I think, because I think it has ramifications at so many different levels. And it's one of my favorite episodes in the series.
And there are five total. I mean, you and your team started off with an idea, and now the first episode is going to debut this week. Were there surprises along the way while researching and putting these episodes together?
One of the things that surprised me was an episode where we featured the Australian psychologist Lucy Hone, and she talks about her own experience with grief after suffering, you know, really what's an unimaginable loss. She lost her daughter in a car crash, and as she was sort of dealing with the grief and her bereavement over her daughter's death, you know, she started thinking about the research and looking deeply at the research, and she expected to go through what many of us expect to go through in the aftermath of something like this, which is the five stages of grief. But as she sort of looked carefully at her own experience and also at the research literature, she found that, in fact, the five stages of grief was not a very good way to conceptualize what happens to people in the aftermath of trauma. In fact, it's not very empirically supported in terms of the research, that's done, that there are, in fact, these five stages that follow one after the other in this very neat fashion for all people. And so I think that was an idea that surprised me, because I feel like I've been hearing about the five stages of grief for, you know, 35 or 40 years. And it was in some ways a revelation that that model of grief might not actually be well supported by the science.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people will appreciate that, right? Because there's not always a handbook on how to grieve, and it's different for everyone. Finally, you know, at the end of this month, when people have listened to all five episodes, Healing 2.0, what do you hope people take away?
You know, I think there are many insights that people can take away from the series, but I think a common theme that comes through many of them is that bad things are going to happen to us, difficult things are going to happen to us. That's inevitable. It's just, you know, just the result of being human and being alive, that things are going to happen to us. But how we think about those things, how we respond to those things, our feelings about those things, in fact, much of that is under our control. Lucy Hone talks about this in her episode, but this is an idea that has echoes in many spiritual traditions that go back centuries or even millennia. I was reading a book the other day about Buddhist philosophy, and there's a story that comes from the Buddha, which is called the story of the two arrows. And the Buddha is supposed to have said that as we go through life, we're often struck by arrows. As we go through the forest, you know, arrows are going to strike us, and those arrows are going to cause us pain and suffering. But the one thing we should not do is we should not compound that pain and suffering by adding a second arrow to the site of the first injury. And that, of course, is what many of us end up doing. When we suffer a setback or a loss or a tragedy, we compound that pain with the thoughts and experiences and the way we process what happened. We have regret and blame and recrimination. We have a lack of self-compassion. And in some ways, we are compounding our pain with a wound that is now self-inflicted. So the second arrow, in some ways, is under our control. I love that idea about the two arrows and how, in some ways, even if we can't stop the first arrow from striking us, we can do something about the second.
The second arrow. Shankar, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Shankar Vedantham is the host of Hidden Brain, discussing his latest series called Healing 2.0, with new episodes every Thursday starting today. And that is it for Insight today. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We will catch you back here on Monday.